Coming up, in many parts of the world, Sunni and Shia Muslims are in violent conflict. Kim Lawton looks at how they get along here in the United States. Also, a 9-year-old Buddhist boy prepares to become a lama.
I'll be praying for them, I'll be chanting for them.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Deborah Potter, sitting in for Bob Abernathy. It's good to have you with us. A new report from the State Department highlights concerns over blasphemy and apostasy laws that limit religious freedom and often impose death sentences for the accused. The report noted particular problems with blasphemy laws in Muslim countries, including Afghanistan, Pakistan, Sudan, and Saudi Arabia. It also noted discrimination against Christians in China and anti-Semitism in parts of Europe. According to the report, 24% of countries, where three-quarters of the world's population lives, have serious restrictions on religious freedom.
The countries across the globe, and I've traveled now to many countries of very different religious majority populations, they see clearly the basic constitutional, institutional constraints against violations of religious freedom in the United States.
In Syria, a gas believed to be chlorine was dropped in a barrel bomb on a neighborhood in Aleppo, killing four people and injuring dozens of others. The Syrian government has denied using chemical weapons during the 6-year civil war, but the U.S. and other Western powers have held the government responsible for past attacks. Near Aleppo, a hospital affiliated with Doctors Without Borders was bombed this past week, killing 13 people, including children. Humanitarian groups have repeatedly blamed the Syrian governments for strikes on medical facilities and have called for a halt. Pakistanis are mourning the deaths of dozens of lawyers and others in a suicide bombing at a hospital in the southwestern city of Quetta. The victims had gathered there after the president of the Bar Association was gunned down. The suicide attack came just hours later. Both the Pakistani Taliban and ISIS claimed responsibility for the bombing. Much of the violence in Quetta has resulted from the targeting of a mostly Shia ethnic minority in the majority Sunni nation. Violence between Sunni and Shia Muslims is all too common in many parts of the world. But those sectarian conflicts have not happened in the United States. Kim Lawton reports on how and why the situation here is different.
During this past Ramadan, in her Pompano Beach, Florida condo, Farida Saleh was getting ready to host a special dinner, an iftar, for family and friends.
The main thing is the dates. It's a sunnah taken after Prophet Muhammad.
During their holy month, Muslims traditionally fast from sunup to sundown, and then break the fast with a celebratory group meal. Saleh and her veterinarian husband, Mustafa, immigrated to the U.S. from Egypt several decades ago. They belong to the Sunni branch of Islam. But several of the Saleh's guests and longtime friends were from the Shia branch.
When I knew those people when I first came, I didn't ask, are you Sunni, are you Shia? And we became close friends.
In many parts of the world, Sunni and Shia Muslims are locked in a deadly cycle of tit-for-tat violence. Here in the U.S., they live side by side in relative harmony. Saleh says she doesn't understand why fellow Muslims would attack each other.
It's crazy. It's extreme. And I feel sad. Those are ignorant or brainwashed because I don't want to blow up myself and say, for the sake of God, I want to do this, boom. This is stupid. I mean, we are here to spread peace and love.
The Sunni-Shia divide began after the death of the Prophet Muhammad in 632 AD. Some Muslims, who had become known as Sunnis, believed his successor should be elected by the community based on merit. Others, who become known as Shiites, believe Muhammad's successor should be someone from his bloodline.
The dispute was over who is going to be the successor, who is going to be the leader. It is dispute over power and privilege.
Imam Abdul Hamid Samra is religious director of the Islamic Center of Greater Miami, a predominantly Sunni mosque which he says also welcomes Shiites. He says when it comes down to the basics, the pillars of Islam, the two share a common core.
They all have the same book, which is the Quran. They all believe the same exact word, which is La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, which means there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger.
The vast majority of the world's Muslims, between 85 to 90%, are Sunni. Over the centuries, different rituals, traditions, and authority structures evolved between the two groups. Many observers compare it to the differences between Catholics and Protestants. Former Pakistani Ambassador Akbar Ahmed is chair of Islamic studies at American University.
The Shia tend to be more hierarchical, more centralized in spiritual authority. That is why you see the emergence of really important spiritual figures like the Ayatollahs, because they're at the top of the hierarchy.
The Shia have special shrines and practices to revere historical imams who are considered martyrs and saints.
We follow the Prophet and his progeny, his family, and down to his grandchildren and take leadership from them and their instructions.
Bushra Razvi serves on the board of the American Islamic Center of Florida, a predominantly Shia mosque.
Who would know you better than your own family? So that's how we kind of feel that, you know, whatever is been passed down to us through the imams and through the Prophet's grandchildren, that's the religion of the Prophet.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
While the two groups offer many of the same prayers, Shiites and Sunnis often hold their hands and arms in different positions. Many Shiites pray with their forehead on a small earthen object called a turba. Some in the Sunni community strongly object to the use of the turba and the Shia devotion to saints. Many U.S. experts on Islam argue that those differences are relatively insignificant.
Shia have very minimum theological differences with the Sunnis. Minimum theological. They're largely political and largely ethnic. The Shia tended to be based in what was Persia, the Persian Empire. The Sunnis tended to be based in the Arab world. And that division still prevails.
Today, Iran is the dominant global Shia influence and Saudi Arabia the dominant Sunni influence. While there have been extended periods and places where Shia and Sunnis have lived together in tolerance and peace, in recent years, old rivalries have come back with a vengeance. At the end of Ramadan in July, hundreds of Muslims, mostly Shiites, were killed in a spate of sectarian attacks in several countries.
You're actually seeing Iraq almost fragmenting as a state. Syria is being challenged as a state. And in that vacuum, you have the old confrontation, the Shia-Sunni confrontation, which lay dormant for a long time, has reemerged. The division has now become so great because it is watered by blood.
So far, those bloody conflicts haven't spilled over to America. Scholars say that may be in part because both branches are minorities here.
Tiny communities don't find it useful to kill each other because they're already so tiny in number. Secondly, we are in America. America is genuinely a pluralist society. So you have every kind of group here, every kind of opinion. So in this environment, the confrontation, the stark confrontation between Shia and Sunni is blurred.
Also, for second and third generation American Muslims, the old sectarian divides from abroad become less important. Nazneen Zaidi is a Shiite who was born in Florida.
When my parents emigrated here in the late 70s, there was no Shia mosque here. And so their first friends were all Sunni. And so my first introduction to Islam was with their Sunni friends.
Zaidi teaches at a Sunni school where she says she's been warmly accepted. She's become close friends with some of her fellow teachers who are Sunni.
As a Shia, I see myself as a Muslim first. Yes, I am Shia. I'm very proud to be Shia. But when I consider myself, and somebody asks me what religion I am, I don't say I'm Shia. I say I'm Muslim. And I think that's how I identify, and I've always identified as that.
Still, there have been some tensions between the two communities. Razvi says sometimes Shiites have not been welcomed at Sunni mosques.
It does happen occasionally, but then it's a small segment of people that I personally feel might be ignorant because they may not have ever been exposed to some Shia people in their community or in their circle of friends, and they just think that whatever you're doing is wrong.
This past Ramadan, her Shia mosque held a special prayer service where the two communities prayed together and then broke their fast together.
It's become like an extended family. There's Shia, there's Sunni, there's men, women, children. And since it's an open environment, you feel more comfortable.
Some worry that tensions could escalate as the U.S. Muslim community grows. Imam Samra believes any lingering prejudices can be overcome with education.
A lot of those people, those extremists from both sides, they use people with less education, they use ignorance.
He says his own faith has been enhanced through knowing Shiites.
We respect one another, and hopefully we understand and learn from each other. And especially when it comes to something good, I would love to take the good thing from anyone.
Many U.S. Muslims say the good Shia-Sunni relations here could be a model for other parts of the world. But Ambassador Ahmed fears that image gets overwhelmed by the anti-Muslim rhetoric of the current political cycle.
The Muslim world looking at the United States is actually seeing images of Islam under attack.
Nonetheless, he believes the positive message of Shia and Sunni living together in peace is one the world desperately needs to see.
America can always be and must be, to me at least as a new American, a beacon for the rest of the world. The world can look at America and say, look, here you have literally a lamb and a lion sitting together in harmony.
Welcome, Bob. Thank you for coming.
I'm Kim Lawton in South Florida.
The Justice Department this week issued a scathing indictment of Baltimore's police department for bias against African Americans.
We conclude that there is reasonable cause to believe that BPD engages in a pattern or practice of conduct that violates the Constitution and federal anti-discrimination law.
The civil rights investigation was launched in the aftermath of violent protests in Baltimore over the death of a 25-year-old black man, Freddie Gray, in police custody. City officials say they have already changed police procedures and will implement additional reforms. In Ferguson, Missouri, hundreds of people gathered this week to mark the 2-year anniversary of the shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager, by a white police officer. Brown's death sparked protests all over the country and led to a national conversation about policing in African American communities. It also fueled the movement known as Black Lives Matter. Pastor Tracy Blackman is one of its leaders.
I think so often we forget, because we are inundated with tragedies in our society, that we move from tragedy to tragedy because it's not personal, right? But if it's personal to you, your life is forever changed by the death of that loved one.
I'm still in pain, you know. I'm still going through. I'm getting through best way I can, and with the support of the community, that's what helps me stand up still.
3 months after Michael Brown's death, violence erupted again in Ferguson when a grand jury declined to press charges against the police officer who shot him. Officer Darren Wilson was also cleared by the Justice Department, but its investigation found patterns of racial bias in Ferguson's police and court system. Earlier this year, the city agreed to make sweeping changes.
I always want to tell people that Ferguson erupted at a time when it had the eyes of the world on it, much like Birmingham, Alabama, which is where I'm from, when people saw all over the country, all over the world, what racial oppression looks like. That happened in Ferguson too. But sometimes we get so caught up in that particular place that we don't recognize that Ferguson is everywhere. So if you are living in America right now, there is a Ferguson near you if you're not living in it, and I want people to remember that. We have a lot of work to do nationally.
A coalition of more than 60 organizations affiliated with the Black Lives Matter movement has issued its first official list of demands. In addition to criminal justice reform and reparations for descendants of slaves, the group called for ending federal aid to Israel, which it said makes the United States complicit in, quote, the genocide committed against the Palestinian people. American Jewish leaders condemned the statement as anti-Semitic and profoundly at odds with a long history of shared purpose between Jewish and African-American communities working for civil rights. According to a new report by the Pew Research Center, Black Protestants are much more likely than other Christians to hear their clergy speak for or against a presidential candidate. In a survey of more than 4,000 adults, researchers found that 3 in 10 Black Protestant churchgoers have heard their clergy speak directly in support of or against a presidential candidate. For Catholics, white evangelical Protestants, and other Christians, the number is 1 in 10 or fewer. Black Protestant clergy who did speak out were more likely to support Democrat Hillary Clinton and oppose Republican Donald Trump. Trump has said he wants to repeal an IRS rule that prohibits clergy from using the pulpit to promote political candidates. Meeting with hundreds of evangelical leaders in Florida this week, he promised that if he is elected president, pastors would not be silenced. In New Orleans, Clinton's running mate, U.S. Senator Tim Kaine, spoke to the Progressive National Baptist Convention, a group of predominantly Black faith leaders. He quoted scripture and told the crowd that only Clinton would address issues like poverty and racial injustice.
We're stronger together. Our strength is in that faith. And together with our congregations, pastors, and community, we've got to make sure people don't lose faith that they can make a difference and that their vote matters.
Our next story traces an ancient trail from Tibet through India to a suburban neighborhood half a world away. In a town whose previous most notable resident was the man who invented the first wearable pacemaker, Fred DeSam Lazaro found a young boy preparing for the role of a lifetime. He's been confirmed by the head of Tibetan Buddhism as a reincarnation of a line of lamas or spiritual leaders dating back 500 years.
They are chants more likely heard in a Himalayan monastery than a working-class Minneapolis suburb. But it's here in Columbia Heights, Minnesota, that 9-year-old Jalu Dorje begins the day in a routine of Tibetan Buddhist mantras, coached by his father. A bit later, there are house calls from volunteer teachers in modern Tibetan. In the calligraphy of the ancient scriptures, a punishing summer schedule for any fourth grader, but not this one.
He has really motivation to learn, and especially, even I know him, he's tired, but he said, no, I'm not tired, and I want to continue, you know. So that really what motivated me also to teach him.
It's a fitting trait because Jalu Dorje has been recognized as a reincarnation of Thaksem Karma Yongdu Choki Nima, an eminent senior lama or spiritual leader who died 9 years ago. He would be the 8th reincarnation of the first Thaksin Lama, who lived in the 16th century. In Tibetan tradition, the process of recognizing a reincarnate varies, depending on circumstances. Spiritual masters divine from a variety of signals. In the case of Jalu Dorje, it was the dream of a senior monk who had visited Jalu's home in Minnesota, which is home to some 3,000 Tibetan Americans, the second in size only to New York. In that dream, tigers roamed in every room of Jalu's house. It was a critical clue in the search for the Thaksin Lama's reincarnation.
The Thaksin Lamas, they used to wear a skirt of the tiger skin. Then I also thought, oh, it might be, you know, because Thaksin Lama was passed away a year before. And everybody's trying to find out his reincarnation.
The question of whether that reincarnation is indeed Jalu Dorje went all the way up to the Dalai Lama, spiritual head of Tibetan Buddhism.
Then His Holiness's prediction was the same, and many other high lamas. So he was confirmed.
In the old days, the boy would be moved to a monastery in Tibet, or now in India, where the Dalai Lama and thousands of followers have lived in exile since 1959. However, the Dalai Lama suggested that Jalu's monastic education be deferred until he's a bit older. The spiritual leader has emphasized that Tibetans, or all Buddhists, must reconcile their traditional belief system with the modern world. He spoke to us last August.
I think science and technology is wonderful. So the religious faith also, you see, particularly Buddhist sort of faith, there are a lot of explanation about the human mind, about nature. So it's something very useful. So therefore, you see, I always appealing, we Buddhists should be 21st century Buddhists.
For Jalu Dorje, that means immersion in ceremony and scripture on one hand, and on the other, a fairly typical Minnesota upbringing. Soccer and swimming are favorite pastimes, as are more sedentary ones, isolated in headphones and a laptop computer. And he's looking forward to fourth grade.
My science teacher told us that we're going to learn about magnets, and we're going to learn about wires and batteries.
That curriculum will change drastically in a Himalayan monastery, perhaps in a couple of years, though an exact date has not yet been determined. After about 10 years in India, he is to return to Minnesota as a spiritual leader.
When you grow older and you've completed your studies, what do you think you'll be doing for people?
I'll be praying for them, I'll be chanting for them.
When I asked what those chants mean, he responded after consulting with his dad, who sat in on our conversation.
It's like meanings of how to help, how your body works. To be nice, to be have peace, and
Not every young lama embraces the rigorous, altruistic calling of meditation and service to others. The modern world can be filled with distraction. All this adds pressure on Jalu's parents, who labor long hours doing janitorial work in Minneapolis. They are committed to help him fulfill the aspiration, not just of a young boy, but it seems of a larger community, one that has even brought them into close quarters with the Dalai Lama.
It was the first time in my 40 years I got to see His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. It is overwhelming for me because ordinary people don't normally have the opportunity to meet him.
It falls to Dorje's dad, who himself was briefly schooled in a monastery.
I'm happy that he has the chance to learn about the modern world as well as the Eastern spiritual wisdom, both combined right from childhood. It's going to be good.
But like every other parent of a 9-year-old, he has strategies, mainly an incentive system, to keep his son on task.
Every time you memorize a set of scriptures, you get a toy, a target, like a set of Pokemon cards or something?
Yeah, mostly that.
He's learning to strike a balance in life, even as ceremonial obligations are being added to his routine. At this gathering, celebrating the birthday of the Karmapa Lama, a major spiritual leader, Dorje came prepared with a book that's popular with grade school readers.
So what did you bring to read today?
Diary of a Wimpy Kid, old school.
Did you bring Pokemon cards?
I snuck them.
Does Dad know that?
No.
So we agreed to keep it a secret between him and the television audience. For the record, the Pokemon cards remained out of sight, and Jalu Dorje remained as attentive as any adult through the 3-hour ceremony. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSam Lazaro in Columbia Heights, Minnesota.
At the Vatican, Pope Francis had lunch with a group of 21 Syrian refugees, including the 12 he brought to Rome from the Greek island of Lesbos earlier this year. Both the adults and children told the Pope about the start of their lives in Italy. The children gave Francis a collection of drawings. The Pope gave them toys and other gifts. The event took place at Casa Santa Marta, next to St. Peter's Basilica. The Pope said the lunch was in keeping with the message of humanity that he wanted to send. Francis also wrote a letter of encouragement to the team of refugees competing at the Olympics. He wished each of the 10 athletes success and said he hoped that they, quote, serve as a cry for peace and solidarity. On our calendar, August 15th is the Feast of the Assumption, when Roman Catholics and some other Christians commemorate the belief that the Virgin Mary was bodily taken into heaven at the end of her earthly life. In the Eastern Orthodox tradition, it's called the Feast of the Dormition. That's our program for now. I'm Deborah Potter. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, music from Hillsong United, Say the Word, shot on the Mount of Beatitudes in Israel. The group recently received a Dove Award nomination for Artist of the Year.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.